Williams and Scott Williams.
That's right.
Sitting in for Earl Ingram this morning. Connor, how do people call into this show?
They call in by calling 844. I got to pull up the rest of the number. It's on my phone, so people.
Okay, let's do this clearly.
Let's do it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Earl just has it right off the top.
I know. He's got it right on the tip. It's about the only thing he's got on the tip of his tongue.
Lies. He's that guy. He's word magic.
Yes. Word magic. All right.
Oh.
Oh, no.
I think I've stumped Connor.
Wow. Hey, that's fine. Yeah. We got to hear the end of it. That's the track. That Charles Bradley song.
Right, I got it. 844-967-2789.
844-967-2789.
8-9.
There it is.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so we've been talking sort of about, we morph from education into just sort of red meat political issues and how it is that it seems that thought processes turn off. But, you know, it isn't, you're right, Scott, it's not thought processes altogether. It evokes fear issues like children's safety, mm-hmm. and the sanctity of my children's education. So when you attack education, everyone can evoke in their own mind fears they have about their kids, right?
But it's a gray area, right? Yeah. It's as far as, you know, families justifiably want to be able to ensure that their spiritual raising of their children, like the spiritual education, and, you know, the moral compass, and that those things are, you know, more squarely influenced by the home and the parenting. But the reality is that, you know, when do they go to school, and if they are intellectually challenged to not not contradict their beliefs, but to think about them in through another lens, that, you know, the teacher's actually attempting to help them become more strongly convicted in their beliefs if that's what they choose, if that's the path that they go down intellectually.
I mean, my sense is,
we're not trying to alter what they believe. You know, teachers and schools and curriculum is designed to challenge students and to think about things deeply and critically, but there is no ideology. The suggestion that there's a narrative that we prefer.
Yeah, I suspect what really is inferred here in Justice Alito's talk about the religion being under attack and religious freedom being under attack in the country might be the fact that those who are deeply religious are having a sense that they are becoming an increasing minority in the country, and so they might feel that the grasp on deep religion is in fact a fragile grasp, and that maybe their children won't be able to absorb critical thinking and hold on to this religious thinking simultaneously. So that's interesting to me, because that suggests to me a fragility in their own mind about exactly how important religion is to them and how sensible their religious views are.
But one thing I worry about, though, is, you know, I go back to the question I asked you earlier, which is, do you think they believe in that, like how desperately important that connection between their own Christian values or whatever the values are,
uh-huh.
and our society, right? And they perceive it to be, you know, diminished and you know, further diminishing all the time. But they believe with their entire being that if that connection were to rupture and no longer be a thing, then our society would unravel entirely.
Yes.
And they believe that.
Yes, they do.
But so in order for us to engage and stop just being polarized and stop just identifying, othering, you know, one another.
Yeah,
I do worry about, like, so how do we approach that person who believes that so passionately and show them that we're not here to demonize and other them, that we in fact want to have a conversation
about. That's my concern. I think that's clear. And in our call-ins, in fact, it's clear that what we need to do is coax one another out of our caves. People retreat to caves when they're afraid. You know, that's our instinct. That's the lizard brain. And then in order to come out and actually converse calmly, you know, we need to be coaxed out of our cave. We need to be coaxed away from this sense that the person we're talking to is actually the enemy. You know, it's mortal combat, a blood sport. It's not, you know.
Hey, if all the Williams were cavemen, mm-hmm. I for sure would have been the best caveman. Maybe one other brother could give me a push, but I think if it was a caveman contest, we have a club and a fire and a cave, I win.
You don't live in a cave?
No. Now he's woke.
Yeah, wherever that in your brain, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, there you go. He solved for that problem. Well, So, you know, but, you know, there's various issues that are red meat. Communism.
Huh.
Communism is a red meat issue. If someone is either a communist or smells like a communist. I mean, ever since Joe McCarthy, you know, Joe McCarthy was a U.S. senator from Wisconsin, from, you know, Winnebago County.
What do communists smell like? Like treachery and cigarettes or what? What do they smell like?
I think a terrible combination of like an ashtray and treachery.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, but... no, the fact is that there are a bunch of issues that we can talk about where we can blank out careful thinking and we can start just waving our arms and arguing with one another or agreeing emphatically. So interestingly, most of the issues that we have that are emotional issues in the United States right now are ones about which we can argue and argue vehemently and never reach agreement on. There's one issue that we seem to be able to reach agreement on, which is clearly, however, an emotional issue, which is communism. And our international affairs, where we've always argued within our country that international affairs need to be an area of bipartisan unanimity. We have to present a strong face to the world.
Did you say bipartisan unanimity?
Yeah, yeah. And our foreign...
Can you say that fast?
Can I say that
more quickly?
Because you think it's a tongue twister?
Well, what was the word we had before the show?
Bipartisan unanimity. Oh,
unanimity.
Yeah, we got it going.
We got it going on.
It's like the phenomenon in the Muppets. Phenomenon. All right, keep going.
Okay. Well, it's hard to stay on track, I'll tell you.
Hey, you invited me, Sam.
When we jumped to the Muppets.
All right, my bad.
No.
Let's go back to communism.
No, we can talk about Snuffleupagus.
I'm going to stare at you like Sam the Eagle. I want you to go back to communism.
Isn't he not like it?
Oh, here we go.
No.
Communist Muppets.
Yeah. So, but communism, foreign affairs, has been an area where we've basically required one another to have bipartisan unanimity because it's unpatriotic otherwise. And patriotism is mandatory. And it's mandatory on both sides of the aisle. And it's almost so mandatory that the liberals and conservatives try and outdo one another in terms of proving just how hawkish they can be. And there's, I guess, the progressive movement on the one hand and the libertarian movement on the other hand, both viewed as fringe movements.
They are.
Both viewed that way are the only ones that seem to be willing to take on foreign policy and try and dissect it and try and figure out whether what we're doing in our foreign affairs makes sense for America, whether what we announce as who we announce as our enemies really are or should be our enemies, and how we conduct ourselves, whether we launch military adventures. All of these things happen with almost unanimity, and those who decide to take on questioning about it have their patriotism brought to task.
It's interesting because it's like, if you look at it, most of the American populace actually agrees with a lot of these ideas or policies when it comes to progressivism or libertarianism, or they're open to those ideals. Like I remember watching some old presidential debate from back in the 2000s with Al Gore and George Bush, and he talked about like how before the war on terror, before all this, he's like, he had a pretty, I would say, libertarian perspective when it came to foreign policy, that we should be calculating, we should understand, we shouldn't be involved in so many separate places. And they use that to rally support, and then when they become into power, they realize the status quo, the power structure that's there, and how every single other person, right, because they're politicians, are motivated by power and by keeping that. And so it's a deliberate ploy to gain votes, or you have politicians that get into the system, realize like how difficult it is to actually change and to actually convince.
I think Washington is submerged in an atmosphere where the foreign affairs and the dogma and the correct stance on foreign affairs is embedded so deeply that if you spend much time in Washington, you just absorb this viewpoint.
Yeah.
And it becomes dogma to you. It's accepted fact.
Yeah, and a lot of the military presidents are kind of like are lauded. They're lauded as being some of the greatest presidents of all time, too.
Interestingly, our military presidents are the ones who ask the most questions about what we're doing. Colin Powell, if he'd become president, I'm confident, would have been a president much less likely to pursue military adventure. Dwight Eisenhower, at his last speech as a president, gave what is now a famous discussion of the military-industrial complex, warning America that he foresaw, and this was really a question of foreseeing it, because it had only been intact for about 10 years and had all developed more or less during his presidency post-World War II, and he could see that the industrial complex that was dependent upon the military, or substantially dependent on the military, was taking a hold of government, was taking a hold of public policy, and was endangering the direction of American policy. And lo and behold, no one would accuse Dwight Eisenhower of having been wrong about that. And the only problem is that no one has figured out how to tame the beast.
Yeah.
You know, the military-industrial complex is a huge beast, and no one has either the courage or has figured out a method for taming that beast.
All right, Sandy, we're going to a break right now, actually. Sorry for...
Oh, that's all right.
Just coming through, but we have like 10 seconds left.
All right. So, okay. Well, we'll come back to the beast.
All right, let's do it.
Rawr.